Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, of course. Well, 2015 is certainly proving to be a lot more interesting than 2014. Volatility has returned to equity markets. The oil market, which continues to flounder at less than half its former highs, is confounding experts. And currency markets, lots of volatility there as well. Now, while the ruble commanded much of the attention in 2014, falling by roughly half, it is the Swiss franc that has so far been the story of 2015. On January 15, 2015, the Swiss National Bank broke the three-year-long peg that had kept the Swiss franc at roughly 1.2 Swiss francs per euro. Within minutes, it soared to just 0.8 francs to the euro, causing a lot of mayhem to a lot of trading accounts, before finally settling closer to parity with the euro at 1-to-1. To help us understand this move, today we're speaking with Axel Merk, President, Chief Investment Officer, and Founder of Merk Funds. Axel is a noted expert on world currencies and manages several mutual funds that manage currency risk for investors. So, nobody better to talk to about this today. And for years, he has been an outspoken critic of U.S. monetary policy, warning investors that the current course risks seriously devaluing the dollar. He is the author of Sustainable Wealth, a very readable guide to understanding our macroeconomic environment, the risks today's investors face, and how they can manage their finances to achieve financial stability. Axel, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Great to be with you, Chris.
Well, you mentioned that there are some, you're a critic of the policies that could lead to risk for the U.S. dollar, but let's turn our attention to what happened over in Europe and what's going on there. It's not every day that a central bank pulls the rug out from under everybody in such a sudden and large way. In fact, as recently as just 3 days before the move, Swiss National Bank President Thomas Jordan said the Swiss National Bank would be maintaining the peg, and then, bam, the peg is gone. What happened?
Well, we can talk about it from many different angles. Let me first take the very big picture view. The fact is that central banks have been masking risk. Risky assets don't appear risky anymore. The Swiss franc didn't appear risky. And as you say, they pull the rug out. It is risky. That can happen anywhere. Now, and we can go into that in a minute. Now, let's go a little bit more technical about what's happening here. First of all, there's one thing I agree with Jordan, that if you are to remove the peg, you've got to do it instantaneously. It doesn't do anybody any good if he's going to say, well, maybe I'll remove it, and maybe tomorrow, maybe next week sort of thing. That would call a market that's just going to pile in on that, and it's going to cause some other sort of distortions and mayhem. So that's no good. The challenge is he really pulled the rug out from under himself as well. The way I see it is, and remember how he got into office. There was his predecessor, Mr. Hildebrand, that put this policy into place, except that his wife was caught currency trading, and so he had to resign. And then Jordan came in, and as far as I can tell, he's more of a bureaucrat, and he's certainly not a charismatic speaker. I don't think he was ever too much on board with this policy, and he got cold feet. He basically said, oh my God, this is going to get too expensive if the European Central Bank is going to engage in quantitative easing, and why don't we cut our losses? The challenge really is that even from the Swiss National point of view, if you put yourself into their shoes, it wasn't handled very well. And the reason I say that, I've never been a friend of the peg in the first place, but the way it was removed was pretty absurd as well. Late November, for example, they lowered interest rates to be negative. And then that worked. That eased the pressure on the Swiss franc. Well, what a prudent central bank would have done is they could have continued to lower those interest rates, and if that didn't work anymore, then to evaluate whether to remove it. Whereas they pretty much pulled the Band-Aid off and stumbled trying to explain it. I'd be very surprised if Jordan is going to be in office a few months from now.
Well, as you mentioned, not even the Swiss National Bank seemed to prepare for the move. They were holding a huge position in euros at the time. They announced the removal of the peg, so they took an immediate 18% loss on that. Why didn't even the SNB prepare?
Well, because it's impossible in some ways. Because the thing is, you can hold a peg, you can debase your currency at any time because you can always print an infinite amount. The only limit to that is political. And if you were to never remove the peg, you'd never have to realize any losses. And so that's the academic theory. Now, the practice, as we see, looks a little bit different because most Swiss people don't really like the euro. They don't like to adopt the euro. They kind of like to export things, but if they were asked, oh, do you like to join the European Union? Would you like to adopt the euro? They would say no. And so there is always this risk of a political backlash. And clearly, with Draghi about to engage in quantitative easing, the question is it worth the risk? Now, the challenge is the arguments that Jordan gave for leaving the peg are the same arguments why they should have never entered it in the first place. Hmm. And so there's a clear lack of consistent policy, and that's one of the things that caught people by surprise. Also note, I haven't seen any headlines of folks making hundreds of millions of this trade. Everybody I see lost money in this. And part of that is that this is a risk that is all but impossible to manage. The biggest duration was about a 40% move. That is unheard of in financial history to have that in a major currency. And think about it, if a major bank provided liquidity for options, well, the same thing as in the stock market. They do delta hedging. They offset their risk. Well, you can't do that if the next price you get is 40% or 20% away from the previous move, when you're expecting on a typical day to have like a fraction of a percentage move, maybe 1, 2, 3% on an extreme day. So these risks were all but impossible to manage. The only way to manage that risk would have been to stay away from the Swiss franc in the first place.
Well, let's talk about managing the risk as well as a political dimension to this. It was just in November 20th that the Swiss voters turned down a referendum to have the Swiss National Bank hold more of its reserves in gold. And at the time, I believe it was the Swiss National Bank president who was out there very loudly saying this would tie our hands, would not give us very much cover. Did this move here did this confirm or did this refute the Swiss National Bank's stance on not wanting to hold gold? That is, did they just give political ammunition to the people who were on the pro-gold referendum?
Well, what it gave ammunition to the folks that say that central bankers don't know what they're up to,
yeah.
that the market pressures are ultimately stronger, and maybe that the best short-term policy is a prudent long-term policy, because if you try, I mean, the reason this quote-unquote peg was put in place in the first place is because the Swiss National Bank said, oh, we don't like this exchange rate here, it hurts our exporters, so let's move it until the market comes our way. Well, guess what? The issues in the Eurozone have just been dragged on. Things haven't gotten dramatically better. You can argue whether things got better or worse. And sure enough, there was still substantial pressure on the Swiss franc to strengthen. And so that means that instead, what should have happened, of course, is that, and one of the things, by the way, that Jordan had said is that, oh, we're doing a favor to Swiss businesses because they have had now a couple of years to prepare for this. Well, the opposite is true. In 2011, when the peg was introduced, the incentive for businesses to hedge currency risk was taken away. They trusted their government. And now they pull the rug from underneath them, and so it caught the business off guard. Ultimately, an advanced economy cannot compete on price. They have to compete on value. And when the rest of the world around them is in shambles, well, what do? You destroy your own economy? Do you destroy your own currency to blend in better? I sometimes compare it to being in a neighborhood where everybody dumps their garbage in their backyard, and to blend in better, the Swiss started to dump their own garbage in their backyard too. And it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, so let's talk about this. You said that a prudent short-term policy is the same as a prudent long-term policy. Now, the Swiss National Bank move, I'm interested. Do you think this is just an indication that a small central bank was caught by forces too large for it? Or does this possibly suggest, gasp, that market forces are actually larger than any central bank?
Well, ultimately, central banks are just zipping from a straw in the ocean. And I didn't invent that term. Our senior economic advisor, Bill Poole, who is the former president of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, taught us this, that central banks are effective as long as there's credibility. Now, that's as far as what he had said. Now, let me add to that. What central banks have done is, as I indicated in the beginning, central banks have been trying to make risky assets appear as risky so that investors are encouraged or coerced into taking more risk, to no longer have cash because you get no interest, or you're even penalized for holding cash. So you got to go out and buy risky assets. You got to buy out and buy junk bonds. You got to go out and buy equities. In the equity market, volatility until not long ago has been very, very low. So when volatility is low, investors are encouraged to buy something that is historically risky, because it's no longer risky, right? Well, as the Swiss National Bank has shown, risk can come back with a vengeance. So the same thing can happen, of course, in any other market. If the Federal Reserve wants to pursue on this quote-unquote exit, if it wants to go down this path, volatility is going to come back. And everything else equal, it means asset prices have to be priced lower. And that is a problem if you base an economic recovery exclusively on asset price inflation. And so we're going to have our hands full trying to kind of move on from here. And in that context, what the Swiss National Bank has done is just a canary in the coal mine, that there might be more trouble ahead.
So this is a very fascinating topic, because this is central to something I've been warning about for a while, which is that the longer the central banks have waded into and become dominant forces in the markets, they've done a number of things, the most important of which I think you've identified. It's not really the driving up of the asset prices that concerns me near as much as the compression of the risk premia. You know, we're seeing this now play out in the junk bond market in the U.S. shale plays, right? There were companies there obviously burning cash, obviously very risky players, obviously exposed to a volatile commodity price, which is oil, and they were paying 5% on their junk bonds, nothing even remotely close to anything historically you would recognize as normal. So let's talk about this for a second, because you mentioned very important. I think this is a central concept. Central banks' effectiveness, it continues as long as they have that credibility. You're suggesting here that the Federal Reserve really is going to have an extraordinarily difficult time trying to get away from its accommodative monetary policies. Let's go further. Do you think they can even do it without suffering that loss of credibility, without financial asset markets revolting?
Probably not. And let's start out with the central theme of Janet Yellen these days, that the Fed will be patient. Well, by saying investors should be patient, what she's really saying is that investors should be complacent, that volatility should stay low, because that's the only way that they can kind of start raising interest rates. Janet Yellen has all but promised to be late in raising rates. If you look at some of the economic numbers, we can argue how good the recovery is, but there are some indications that maybe we haven't turned the page yet, and maybe we shouldn't be, because we shouldn't be at a 0% interest rate environment if things are really that great. And as you move higher, these risk premia have to expand, asset price will have to be repriced. And obviously the Federal Reserve is supposed to focus primarily on the U.S. economy, shouldn't be worrying about what others do in the world, but there are ripple effects. The Wall Street Journal for now has finally started to say, well, the strong dollar is hurting some exporters, and so some people will start complaining. The low oil prices are destroying the high-paying jobs, and we're creating low-paying jobs. Wages don't go anywhere. And sure, if you push the accelerator hard enough, we will get some growth somewhere. But I think, yes, Janet Yellen is going to have a hard time. If you go back to what Bernanke always used to say, he always said, is when you're faced with a credit bust, such as the Great Depression, the biggest mistake is to withdraw monetary accommodation too early. Meaning, if you tighten too early, the deflationary forces will take over again. And that's why, and I'm interpreting here, you've got to be late in raising rates, which means that you have to wait until inflation shows its ugly head, because that's something that central banks think they know how to handle. And that is why Janet Yellen will be, quote-unquote, late in raising rates. And so if you ask me whether she can raise rates, yes, she will be raising rates, but she'll be raising nominal rates. If you look at real interest rates after inflation, they are negative in the U.S., they are negative in the Eurozone, they're negative in Japan, and I am almost certain that in a year from now, they'll continue to be negative in those regions in the world. Because even as nominal rates will go up, I would think that real interest rates will continue to be negative. They might even be more negative than they are today.
So this is a fascinating idea, because, you know, the central theme, the narrative that you've just outlined is, look, we have to be patient. And Bernanke has said, you know, the big mistake is to just come out of this stuff too early. So let's talk about Japan for a second. Hasn't Japan basically proven to the whole world that a central bank can go actually too far and still not achieve its inflationary aims? I mean, the Japanese bond market, it's now recognized as being completely dead, leaving the Bank of Japan as pretty much the sole participant. They've had an enormous increase in the monetary base. That's been achieved, and yet nothing of note is really happening with inflation itself, inflation expectations, or economic growth. What's going to be different this time in the U.S. and in Europe?
I don't think we have seen anything yet with the Japanese, by the way. I mean, they're taking a step back for now, but they haven't handed out cash to citizens yet. There are all kinds of things they'll try. I mean, they have Kuroda and Draghi get together, and they'll think of something of what else they're going to do. Just because the policy doesn't work doesn't mean they won't double down. And so it's a and of course that causes ripple effects in other markets. Now, the one thing that everybody thinks is that, oh, okay, the Japanese have printed money and the currency weakened, the stock market went up, that the Draghi is about to do the same thing. I'm not so sure whether that's actually going to happen exactly in the same fashion because of the headwinds that the Federal Reserve is going to create. I don't think the Federal Reserve will be able to tighten significantly, but they will try, and just the attempt is going to cause ripples around the world. And so everybody who knows exactly the playbook as it's going to play out, because it's happened like this before, is going to be in for a surprise. So that's one of the reasons why volatility is back. And as we discussed earlier, volatility is the enemy of inflated asset prices.
Indeed. Well, certainly we've got volatility coming back. So, well, then let's turn to today's leaked announcement, today being Wednesday. What do we got here? The 21st. And today's leaked announcement was the European Central Bank's quantitative easing program. The QE is now going to be pegged at 50 billion euros a month. I guess that's 600 billion euros a year. Mario Draghi has said with this quantitative easing that Japan has tried and hasn't worked, and the U.S. has tried with questionable results. He says he's trying to fix inflation, which is too low. First, why is low inflation exactly bad for the people of Europe? And second, is that what he's really targeting with QE?
Yes, a couple of things. First of all, we are the day before the actual announcement. We've had just so many leaks about the program that we think we know everything. The only thing Draghi is going to add in the actual announcement is that he's going to potentially modify the program. He has said in the past he's willing to modify the size, composition, and the pace of the balance sheet. And with that, he's going to threaten to do more, that his bazooka is bigger, and so forth. Now, to your question, though, what is he achieving? Well, that's a fabulous question, because last time I checked, German five-year notes were at negative yields. Even the borrowing cost in the European periphery has plunged. Low interest rates are not the problem that Europe is facing. Europe is facing a lack of structural reform. The one country that has done structural reform is Germany. They're doing actually quite well. They don't need QE. The other countries that should have structural reform want QE, but once you have, of course, the asset purchases by a central bank, you have a disincentive to engage in structural reform. What Europe needs is banks that are not impaired. They're working on it, but it takes time, because in Europe, lending goes to the banking sector rather than to the credit markets. Banks are the traditional way that people get loans. Those are the ones you need to fix. If you want to boost European growth, you need to get rid of sanctions against Russia. I'm not saying that politically that's a good or bad decision. I'm saying that economically that would boost the European economy. Printing money doesn't solve anything. The one thing that printing money does is it puts pressure on the euro. Even there, the announcement of QE, at least with regard to the Fed, has been far more effective than the actual money printing. In the Bank of Japan, the printing itself also weakened the yen, but the program was magnitudes larger than anything that's proposed anywhere else in the world. And so it's really questionable how effective it's going to be to do what Draghi says, the reason he's doing it. He says that inflation expectations are too low. He wants them to be back up at 2%. And then back to your question, are low inflation expectations, is low inflation a bad thing? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you have a lot of debt, you want inflation. If you're a saver, you don't want inflation. So the interests of governments are not aligned with the interests of savers. That's really the core problem. And in the U.S., inflation expectations have also come down, not quite as much as in the Eurozone. Bernanke would have spooked by now, but now it said, oh, low oil prices isn't the problem. Well, in the U.S., actually, some businesses do suffer from low oil prices, the shale industry. In Europe, the Eurozone is an oil importer. Europe benefits greatly from low oil prices, so they should be happy about it. But Draghi is using it as an excuse, because weakening the euro is a stimulus that makes the European periphery in particular more competitive, and it's far less painful than telling folks that they have to cut their salaries to be more competitive.
Now, when you said inflation benefits debtors more than savers, obviously hurts savers, benefits debtors, isn't that really actually true if and only if you have rising income at the same time? I mean, if I'm holding a big piece of debt and we have general inflation, and that's costing me more in terms of, I don't know, my healthcare costs more, tuition costs more, food and fuel costs more, but my income isn't rising, that actually harms me even in the inflationary environment, right?
Well, of course. I mean, high inflation has never led any country to prosperity, but it is the path of least resistance. When you have a lot of debt, wouldn't you love it if the value of your debt was debased? Now, clearly, your income has to grow at the same time, otherwise it doesn't work. And in practice, of course, that doesn't happen because printing money doesn't create real income, real wages, and so forth. But it makes you live for another day. It eases the pressure. If you can have a magic wand called the printing press, it is so much more pleasant than if you actually have to engage in structural reform. If you've ever tried or watched in your local community when they're trying to take a benefit away, how much of a fight that is. Well, think about on a national scene, cutting pension benefits is a major battle. Well, why not just have a handout and print some money? Politically, that's much, much easier. And so that's and what's happened, of course, in Europe is that many of the political parties have suffered. More populist, smaller parties are on the rise. And that's really one of the dangers when you drag on structural reform, that the smaller parties that are on the fringe are crowding out the bigger mainstream parties. And the policies those guys want don't necessarily make things better. And so that means you're going to have a political disintegration and you might have chaos down the road. And then Draghi thinks, well, printing a little bit of money might not be the worst of all choices. And so he says he's not political because he's just sticking to the legally mandated inflation target of 2%. But, of course, everything he does is highly political.
Of course, of course. Now, for the benefit of myself and some other listeners, when you say structural reforms, give us a couple of examples. You might have mentioned a few there with pension reform or things like that. But when you say structural reforms, Germany's undertaken them, other countries need to. What do you mean?
Well, structural reform is such a wonderful, benign term, but it really means that countries need to get their act together. That means that it shouldn't take you 12 months to get a license to start a business. Mm-hmm. It means that you need to balance your book on the government side. It means that you need to be competitive on a global stage. You need to be locally be able to balance your books. And you can do that by raising revenue or cutting expenses. Well, most of these countries already have very high taxes. So what you need to do is you need to be able to balance your books in a way that doesn't make everybody suffocate. And so it means you need to allow people to work. It means pension benefits. It means minimum wages are very harmful in that. If minimum wages are high, many jobs are not being created. If the pension age is too high, if healthcare benefits are too high, and so clearly we're talking here about very, very important social issues, and it is politically extremely difficult to make some changes here. Ultimately, what it comes down to, however, is that we have made promises, and with we, I'm referring to Europeans, to Americans, to Japanese. The developed world has made promises they cannot keep. And that is the problem. And structural reform is to try to bring in line the liabilities together with the assets. And so that revenues and expenses are brought back in line, at least in the way that they're sustainable. Most of these countries don't think they're going to be debt-free, but you've got to be able to live another day. And many of these countries have policies where they can have deficits of, say, 2-3% if they were able to achieve it. And that might even work for an extended period if they can get 3% growth. But they have aging societies, and if they don't pursue some of these steps in reform, they can never get the growth back. And so they'll just drown in the debt they have.
Excellent response. Thank you for that. That really helps clear it up. So I think I've got a picture now. The Swiss National Bank has spent 3 years defending this peg, and it's increasingly expensive for them. And it's providing limited returns back to their country in terms of export competitiveness, other things like that. So the risk that the cost return ratio starts to go a little upside down on them. And then Jordan has to be looking forward and saying, oh my goodness, looks like Draghi's serious about this QE. This QE thing is going to happen. That is only going to increase the pressure. He's got to get out before while the getting is still relatively good. In this story, does the potential Greek exit weigh into this at all for him?
Well, only that because the fundamental issues in the Eurozone haven't been resolved, that does create opportunities for crises to pop up. And obviously, we have an election in Greece coming up, and odds are that the current opposition party is going to get huge gains. And so with that, there's a threat that they're going to default on their debt. I'm actually quite certain that that's going to happen at some point in time. They'll need to restructure their debt. And the question is, what are the implications for the euro and for the world? The big thing that has changed is that a couple of years ago, it was European banks that held the Greek debt. Those were risk-averse investors. In the meantime, everybody knows that Greek debt is risky, which means at least from outside of Greece, the folks holding Greek debt are hedge funds. They are risk-friendly investors. That means if Greece is to restructure its debt, it's not going to have it's not going to cause a financial meltdown. I'm sure there might be some nervousness in the market, and we've seen that as the markets have turned negative on Greece, including the bond markets, the other European markets were pretty much shielded. There wasn't a so-called contagion. But of course, that doesn't mean that Jordan didn't and the Swiss National Bank weren't afraid that it might. You just don't know what's going to happen. And so it comes back to this thing: you need to have a longer-term philosophy on how you approach those things. And clearly, the Swiss National Bank didn't have it. If the summary just gave. If Jordan had given that summary, I think he would have gotten away with it. Instead, he looked like a school child who didn't get his homework done when he gave his press conference.
No, it was pretty awkward. Maybe, as you mentioned, he might not be the best public speaker. So let's talk about what this means going forward. You know, from my perspective, in my lifetime, it seems to me like central banks have gone from sort of quiet background stewards of fairly ho-hum monetary policy to very, very active in market engaged individuals, to the point that this might be a false perception, you could have a different one, but it appears to me that every time the market seems to have a little bit of weakness, one Fed official or central bank official or another comes out and says calming words, and this might be on a 1% or 2% decline, very nominal, tiny down moves. It feels to me in my seat that it looks like these central bank officials are now so caught up in this narrative of propping markets, of shepherding them, of being the stewards of them, of rising asset prices, that they feel responsible. I might have this wrong, but that's how it looks to me. That they feel responsible for things that weren't typically in their kitchen, such as maintaining market stability and even targeting rising asset prices as if there's a correct value they know. Is that a misperception? And if not, where does this mean we're headed?
Well, I think the perception you're describing is one that many people have. If you ask any Fed official, they'll deny it. Mm-hmm. And they might not even do it intentionally, at least some of them not. There are a few folks that they seem to have press secretaries these days, these regional Fed presidents, to go out and speak on CNBC and whatnot as much as they can. That is historically not the role and the job that they have. And you're absolutely right. They have gotten very involved. The problem with even in the Fed minutes to state that one of the quote-unquote benefits of the Fed policy has been rising asset prices is that they own the problem, that when asset prices come down, everybody is begging the Fed to print more money. And that is not the role of a central bank, but that's exactly the sort of policies we've put in place. I mean, you've seen all these tweets and studies that the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve is highly correlated with the length of the FOMC statement and things like that. Things shouldn't be that complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's though the world we have gone to, that central banks manage things more and more. I mean, basically what has happened is that we've printed all this money. We have created this amazing asset bubble. The folks who have assets have benefited from that. The folks who don't have assets have been left out, and now we have a call for policies to tax the rich and give it back to the poor. I mean, it's all absurd. Instead, we should have had policies in place that help one build a solid business without any of the distortions of the central bank, whereas we're creating these distortions, and then policymakers come in and say, oh my God, we got to fix it because there's some people that are abusing the system. Well, of course people abuse the system because the central bank pretty much forces you to engage in speculation.
Very well said. That's pretty much my view at this point in time. So as I look at this, everything is hinging then on this central bank credibility. And by the way, I think they've already lost their credibility with me because I don't think you can, that they're trying to have the tail wag the dog, right? If they can just engineer these inflated asset prices, the rest will take off. Look, Axel, how many years into this experiment are we? We have some growth. There's a little bit more in the U.S. than elsewhere, but when you average out global growth, you get fairly anemic numbers. And that seems to be mirroring the example in case of Japan, which basically says once you get yourself over a certain threshold of indebtedness, it becomes very difficult to foster the kind of growth we've had in the past that would be justification for the levels of debt we're taking on and holding. Follow that circle around. To me, it seems quite likely that the Fed has, they tried like the Dickens since 2008 to give us a return and resumption of the credit market heydays that we had prior to that crisis. We didn't get there. As you mentioned, they'll probably double down before they give up. But in that process, what are the chances, you think, of them, the central banks in the developed world, engineering this to a happy place versus the chances of them engineering this to a very unhappy place?
Well, you got to define what happy and unhappy is. And I say that
here's happy then. 3% inflation, 2-3% inflation, 6% nominal GDP, 3% real.
I talked to a current Fed president. It was a private conversation. So I'm not going to name his name. Mm-hmm. And kind of told him that I don't think that we can afford positive real interest rates over an extended period over the next decade. That we have negative interest rates now, and in a decade from now, the kind of if we had economic growth, it would be impossible to finance our deficit because we'd have $1 trillion potentially more in interest expense alone if our interest rates went back up to historic averages, and so forth. And he kind of interrupted me and said, "Well, that's not really possible because that wouldn't be a stable equilibrium." And I said, a side effect of that is that interest rates will have to be low. That the Federal Reserve has an incentive to keep real interest rates slightly negative. And my answer to that was, I never said this would be stable. So this is something that we have, in Economics 101 or maybe 201, they tell you that a central bank is supposed to be independent, they're supposed to only talk about inflation and so forth. As long as the fiscal side is doing a prudent job, we can have central bank independence. But once the fiscal side is in disarray, it just doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, then we gotta find out how we're gonna proceed. What are we gonna do about it? And ultimately, there's always the central banks that cave in and try to inflate their way out of it. And that's really the problem, that we don't have a path forward that's going to have a happy ending because we're not going to get huge entitlement reform in the U.S. The structural reform in the Eurozone is going to be haphazard, and we already see in Japan that the sort of reforms that are in place are not really working.
All right, so final question then, as we look into the future around this, what's the role of gold in all this, given what you see probably transpiring with ECB, Fed, Bank of Japan, all that?
Well, gold is a brick, right? It's a shiny, shiny brick. And the good news about gold, and it's the same as the bad news about gold, it doesn't pay any interest. Well, when cash is being penalized through negative real interest rates or outright nominal interest rates that might be negative in some parts of the world, then suddenly a brick becomes quite an attractive alternative. And that's really the thing is that the reason why, first of all, gold had soared, obviously, 12 years in a row went up. That means people had piled on with leverage. And then as that normalized, gold plunged quite a bit. But ultimately, and then the question is, are we going to have this great exit in the U.S.? And still now, the U.S. dollar is much stronger versus the major currencies versus 6-7 months ago. But gold has been keeping up. And the reason gold has been keeping up is not just because Greece might have an election that we don't like. I don't think so. No, gold has been holding up because the Federal Reserve will be patient. Because real interest rates in the U.S., even if they tick up, are going to continue to be negative. Because we're going to have the next economic downturn, in my view anyway, before real interest rates are going to be positive. And in a decade from now, real interest rates will also be negative. And so gold, in my view, is one of the easier investments. There is no easy answer. Completely safe, it is not either if your daily expenses are in U.S. dollars. And people have seen that very painfully as the price of gold has come down. But the reason why I like gold and we like gold in our business is because of these issues that that when everybody's debasing the currency, well, gold that's more difficult to debase, meaning increasing production is more difficult, is looking like quite a decent competitor.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, last we talked, you had just launched OUNZ, your flagship gold offering. How's that going?
Oh, very nicely so. I mean, the Merck Gold Trust is an exchange-traded fund where investors can buy gold through an ETF. And one of the nice things is that investors can take delivery of the gold. We just completed today another delivery. Somebody took 40 ounces of gold to their home. We hold London bars in London, but at the time you take delivery, people can exchange it. ETF.com just nominated it to as one of the most successful or innovative, I believe, ETF launches of 2014. The one thing that investors may want to be aware of, that taking delivery of the gold in itself is not a taxable event. What that means is that you're just taking delivery of what you already own. With the other gold ETFs, you'd have to sell your ETF, potentially pay taxes, and then with the proceeds, you can buy your coin, whereas with Ounce, you can just request that the gold is sent to you that you already own through the shares, and your original cost basis when you acquired the shares is going to be retained. And so if the price of gold appreciates, that's a feature that some investors may appreciate.
That's a fantastic feature. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Axel Merk. You can find out more at merkinvestments.com. If you do that, merkinvestments.com/insights, you can follow some of his latest writing. He's got a piece up today on the 21st. January, very good. Also follow him at twitter.com/AxelMerk, spelled AxelMerk. So Axel, thank you so much for your time. Is there any other place that we should direct people if they want to find out more?
No, please come to our website, follow me on Twitter, follow our newsletter. So that's we'd love to have you as a follow-up.
Great insights there. Learned a lot reading your piece today on the Eurozone. So Axel, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.